Do we have any observations or comments or questions from the audience? Joe?
One is an observation, but I'm sort of bringing in some of the comments that were made earlier about procurement and small practices. Shane's comment about 95% of non-profit. That might be a point that the RSUA could make to CPD in relation to the whole sort of culture of knocking out the quality of architecture and or the opportunity for those small practices to actually do things that they want. Because you're right, if you're designing for profit, the architecture gets knocked out eventually because it's floor space.
This is real top of the head stuff, I could be wrong, but I'm almost thinking that there isn't a single building there designed by any of those architects who had ever designed that sort of building before. In other words, none of them had three of them in the bag in the last 5 years. None of them, not one, no matter what size it was. I mean, Shane de Blacker may have done one or two university buildings, but nothing, you know, one or two.
We tried to. You're in front of clients and you're getting the opportunity to do something you haven't done before. It's to say, you're not bringing the preconceived notion, the plan that you've done, the problems that you've fixed. You're looking at a brief anew so that you will get a different answer because the other answer wasn't necessarily right for the next client. It's worked once.
Well, Anne, you probably would find, you know, that in your travels around any of the other art centres that there wasn't going to be an off-the-shelf solution.
No, because the answer is the same because the question isn't the same. Procurement is something I didn't know anything about until I began the process of commissioning the MAC, and now I know a lot about it. And it seems to me that it changes. You know, the preferred type of procurement has changed in the, I don't know, 10 years that I've been working on. Well, it was 2007 when we began, 2006 when we began the conversation about procurement. And again and again, those who were exhorting design and build argued that it wasn't about cheapness, it wasn't about value for money. I never quite knew what it was about. But it was on the argument of design quality and the nonsense which is innovation, in terms of the ongoing realization of a design vision that was the basis in which we argued, and it took a long time to win the argument.
Can I ask Eleanor what your comment is on the non-profit?
Well, I was going to talk about two things. One was thinking about this. It's really easy to get compartmentalized into healthcare housing or community architecture or sort of stuff like this. And actually, before Cave, I worked with the Peabody Trust, and one of the things that was incredibly successful there was a couple of occasions where, okay, I really agree with sort of Shane's thing that the domestic house is the laboratory. But quite a lot of times we took people who had never done housing before, you know, Cartwright Pickard building these sort of like mad off-site modules that we were sort of doing. And it was actually about saying, like, you haven't really done mass social housing, you haven't sort of done, and that's why we want to see what your take is. We don't want the recycled ideas. And a lot of that was to have the courage to say, Peabody can say we are a strong enough client to be able to tell you, you don't have the experience in managing and designing social housing. We do, but actually what we want is the way that you think, what your sort of like process is. So that was the first one. I think Shane's separation of not-for-profit and profit is actually really subtle, even within something as volume house builders. But you look at, you know, organisations like Urban Splash, you look at sort of people who've actually grasped that the value proposition is different. It is about what you put into it as much as what you sort of get out. And I think that's where the thing from the not-for-profit comes in. It's because, you know, you have the bottom line where everything is sort of like tangibly put together, and then there has to be something more. So I think it's a really telling one. I think it's a really useful thing, you know, kind of start sitting there and categorising this stuff that we've got not quite in segment. But yeah, okay, that sort of sits there. And I think you're right, there are lots of, and certainly I'm thinking of a lot of the theatre and arts council clients we've worked with who were so, you know, they were publicly funded or even engaging with some, like, you know, private developers, but somehow they brought them across that not-for-profit, we are doing this for other reasons. Mm-hmm. So it's a very, very potent idea.
So I suppose a non-profit thing actually applies to the practice of architecture as well. You know, I imagine you put a lot more hours into this than
Well, that was one thing, certainly, you know, you find with all the analysis, you know, when I was at Peabody, people say, okay, you know, how's a corporation come to you and says, so how are you going to do this again? You say, well, actually, I don't think you can. There was no way we could ask, you know, the architects, the, you know, the construction team to put the time, to put the guts, to put that sort of thing in time and time and time again. And so maybe that's where the responsibility to extract that learning and knowledge is, because it is an extremely, you know, to put the intensity into those two projects that you showed, and to continue to do that is very special.
The project at Copenhagen, I'm still reflecting on the idea of profit. Sparing off some brands. The project in Copenhagen, I was chatting with Shane earlier about the way that the Danish authorities agree and establish how they pay you. It was quite interesting. We had a list that we had to fill in, and at the top of the list there was, I don't know, a senior engineer, and at the bottom there's a draftsperson, and in between there's a senior architect and a middle architect, you know, another draftsperson, and there's maybe about 20 people. And they asked you to tell them the number of hours that each of these people would do and how much each one would get paid for each hour. And you just say, this is our recipe. And I think in that way, I think, you know, at least some of the teams who entered, I suppose, were able to say, we do more hours, you get more of us. Here, it's not really done like that. The culture is one of risk aversion, and you want a client wants experience because they're perceived and they feel that they've been told that is their key, should be their key concerns, that they should avoid risk. If they could understand that they get a raw deal, at least in the terms of hours spent, from a larger, more experienced kind of team, because of their overheads and their business model is different than the small team whose inexperience might be outweighed by their, you know, enthusiasm and endeavour. But how do you, I don't know, how you communicate that to them?
I think one of the other things which really is a question I have to engage with is this sense of whole life value and how we bring that into this sort of sense of costing. And I've had a really interesting conversation with a firm who specialise in a lot of sort of green architecture and stuff and risk taking, and they've cut a fee deal where if they aren't delivering on the energy and carbon savings over the next sort of like 5 years, they've sort of said, you'll pay us this much, and then we are confident we're going to close that design performance gap, we are actually really going to get those savings for you, and that's what you're going to pay us for. And actually there are ways to start to sort of say, you know, I trust my ability to do this, I'm not going to get something caught up on the thing. But it's about really redistributing this.
Does anybody think that the kind of the post-bubble situation will change or can change the way particularly governments look at procuring buildings? I mean, that we would get out of this notion that you can get buildings for free, in other words, they're off balance sheet. You can kind of do a mortgage for 30 years on a building instead of paying for a building up front, and it doesn't appear on your capital costs, you know? I mean, that's the crack we've been at for the last while. In other words, we'll let our children pay for the building that we want now. Does anybody think that people will wake up and say, that's what got us into all this bloody trouble?
Well, part of the challenge that we've had in this is that we've had the government, I mean, we were with Minister Sally Wilson last week talking about this very thing. He said the construction industry are great at talking about bringing in private money, but they never bring any solid ideas. And we did discuss the whole business of building schools by PFI, which generally are not high standard buildings. And, you know, the point was actually came through and everybody was agreeing with the fact that if you try to transfer that risk to the private sector, to allow them to provide money to build buildings, say for example new schools. Because you've got to pay extra to make that risk, to allow those boys to put money up for 30 years, it actually costs more money. And then whenever the accountants look at it and they're sitting with the civil service and Stormont to say, PFI or private finance or a lift scheme, it doesn't add up. But, I mean, we've had absolutely real problems in getting through to government here, with the central procurement directorate, local authorities, everybody, in relation to this whole idea of design quality and how you put that forward. And, you know, you almost feel as if they're sort of like lemmings, that they want to just appoint their own architect all the time, because it's down to actually who can answer the best questions. You know, it's just, it's really got to a very, very extreme situation, and we just don't seem to be able to break through. That's why I was wondering if under CABE there was some sort of mechanism under design quality indicators, or if there's some mechanism to try to persuade government that this is not just some subjective thing which is a big, big risk for civil servant, but there must be some way that you can quantify design quality in an architect to be able to, a good architect for the job.
Yeah, I mean, I've been involved in the DQI since, like, really its inception, so like years and years, and the sense of actually getting it in the Treasury Green Book. This is the Bible, which, you know, procurement. Basically, anybody procuring a building, a factory, a nuclear submarine was supposed to sort of like start with and say, yeah, how are we going to tell if this is good value or not? And to actually get there saying, you know what, there's something about design, there's something you might be able to sort of measure, but I mean, you have to think about the bigger issue, was it felt like an amazing first step. But I think the only reason we got it in there, in sort of like 2003, 2004, whatever it was because the Treasury didn't actually really understand what they had done. They didn't understand that they'd opened the doors to sort of something really big. And then it was exactly the experience that you're describing of suddenly civil servant backtracking and going, oh my God, you know, actually maybe this means we have to engage in a different way. Maybe this means that we can't sort of like roll out a whole sort of series of you know, convenient sort of like school programs. Maybe we're all going to have to sort of think about things. Maybe we are going to have to engage. And that's where I think things started to get sort of scary. And I think, you know, particular political situations and economic situations somehow, you know, can be used. It's odd. It felt like it was the beginning of the battle. The first sort of like volleys. The first sort of like salvos. And hopefully there's enough people sort of like out there who've started to pick up on those who can sort of like continue to fight the battle.
One of the things that struck me today though is the value of a client who isn't just pleased but loves their building. And that's a really strong advertisement for good design. And maybe we need to exploit that more. Sorry, exploit is maybe not the right word, but because there's a building that Shane showed that I went to write about Doug Shockland, and it was really not loved, that building. And it was really unfortunate because, you know, it was an award-winning building and everything else. But to figure out what it is to get clients to love their building, maybe it's about having a long genealogy of viewing the project since 1996, and maybe try to develop that more often in projects. But also to then, when you have a happy client, to really play that up. Don't just stop, you know, at defects after 12 months or something, but to really celebrate, you know, the people who use it and the clients who love their building, which clearly...
Yes, because I can't imagine how awful it would be to have gone through a version of the process you went through and to not be happy with the end result. The process would probably be having more or less the same. The fact was that again and again, Haggerwell McKnight listened to us, and again, they amended and changed the design directly in response to what we were telling them. They could just as easily not have, but they did. And that makes all the difference. You know, and again, it's not to say that this is a perfect building, but it's our shared building. We designed it together. I keep thinking about that procurement thing, Norman, because it's like this whole process. I've been trying to catch a hold of the head of the beast or the tail of the beast for years. Who is it in this system that's actually driving us down roads we don't want to go down? And I don't think anybody is. I don't think anybody's in charge or in control. And again, we quoted back to the people who were trying to stop us from who were trying to force down a design and builder, and we quoted back to them their design excellence policies, their documents that they had drafted, their criteria, which they had enshrined within their funding guidelines, which was about the pursuit of design excellence. I don't know that that swung it. I don't know how we managed to overturn.
You were lucky.
You were very lucky.
I think it's a good plan. I think that what's missing in all this stuff is that we don't have good plans. We don't have the individual people who are prepared to put their neck on the line to get what they want to get. And that's the big problem, I think, with public procurement, is that there's so many layers of so-called accountability, but nobody is personally accountable for anything because nobody wants to put their neck on the line.
Yes.
You put your neck
on the line. I didn't. I just want to thank you for giving the opportunity. Barry Todd put his neck in the line of that argument. Barry Todd had the gravitas and the authority. He happened to be the chairman of the Ministerial Advisory Group on Architecture and the Built Environment at that point. He knew what he was talking about. I didn't know anything about procurement. I would not have been an able, competent in that conversation because I'm not a designer or an architectural professional. But having someone who was at that level, who understood the issues and was able to, with absolute tenacity, pursue the agenda as we needed it to be pursued.
But the difference is, though, that I still put you as being the good client because you trusted the person who knew what they're talking about to do the right job for you. That makes you a good client. Other clients are not good clients, and they wouldn't have trusted Barry to have gone down that route. They would have just said, the people tell me not to do it, so therefore I won't do it.
I think a lot of the time as well, you don't actually get to talk to the client at all.
Yeah.
We're doing a number of schemes at the minute where we're talking to the project manager, who talks to the senior project manager, who reports to the client, and I think that's a kind of this systemic kind of.
I think as Shane said, Hans Olein says that architecture is a political act, and here it's very political at the moment. The clients that we have are the politicians, so we don't actually, unlike your case, come into direct contact with the real clients. Like if we're doing a school, we very rarely are allowed to make contact with the teachers or the people who are using the buildings. We make contact with the project managers and the politicians who are arranging all the procurement. And it's only where we do interact directly with the clients where the building is successful. You know, like in your situation where you interacted directly, the person using it interacts directly. And it seems to be happening less and less now. And with all respect to CABE, it seems to be that CABE has actually lost, in the last few years since the present government got in. It's started receding here anyway.
Well, it's gone from 120 people to being 70.
But do you notice it?
But I think the other thing that's really clearly sort of being brought up here is this sort of sense of continuity. And again, something... Too long we've sort of compartmentalised, there's the first briefing bit and then there's the client's responsibility and then there's the commissioning client and then it gets passed over and then it gets novated to sort of a contractor and then it gets handed over and then the client and then you use it. And that's the one thing what we know is a whole series of broken chains. Whereas the story that I've heard here was it was actually about really engaging with that sort of like first briefing and working the way all the way through to, a perfect description of, I don't know if you've come across the soft landings process, which is how do you have a handover of a building where the user and the designers are actually explained this is how the building works to the extent of, you really don't want to have those sort of drawings. That is what it is about. It's about sort of saying, you have my idea at the beginning of this journey, and we can't just give it to you and, walk away. We have a long-term commitment to this object we built, this organisation we're supporting to do things, this whole sort of process. And we have a whole series of, stages of work, procurement processes, which are all about breaking up responsibility and setting up these sort of like separate barriers and the way that we're paying someone. And sometimes it takes a really good, bloody-minded client to break through and to make those chains of commitment.
It's also very practical. I had the day before yesterday, I was standing at the back. And because I've been involved from the start, Kieran, our fantastic project sponsor, we were trying to solve the parking situation, and there is a solution. It's just that we need to have the ground sorted. It's at the back of the building, And currently about 8 cars are parking illegally and they're all sort of nudging out and falling out onto the road. And Karen said, but the thing is, if we do what roads is going to make us do, there'll only be space for 2 or 3 cars. But and that could have been problematic if the client had gone back to the architect, can you give us a building that there's only 2? But I knew and I remembered that we always knew that at the very most there was going to be parking for 2 or 3 cars. It could be blue badge holders or for the Arctic. It's not designed for parking. It's designed as a loading bay for the Arctic truck and the sets to come off. A happy byproduct will be that on occasions there's space for new cars. That sort of made me think, gosh, it's really practical. The other thing I think, to be fair to clients, is that because I work in the arts, I'm surrounded by an entire society that thinks that the arts are a club that they're not part of. And it's not that way at all. They think that there's a secret language going on with the arts that they haven't got the Google Translator app for. And it's not that way at all. You just need to come in and ask the questions. So as clients, we have a huge, as you know, admiration, respect for the architectural and practice of Academic Night and for all architects. But we were never shy about saying why and no and don't you remember we said and that absolutely can't be the way. I mean, I remember having an argument with a heated and fun discussion with Mark, you know, where he very much wanted to have a space in the building which is now currently and always had to be and had been designed as such as the back of house facility for the studio theatre on the first floor. And it was a wonderful opportunity to have yet another gorgeous look outside the building. It would be fabulous for the public to come up. And again, I said, Mark, no, that's where the actors come in, that's where the sets stay. That's where they do handle it. No. So, you know, you do need to be strong and you need to know your business. It's not the fault of local authorities. It's not the fault of, you know, it's only students. It's only pupils who know what it is like to sit in the classroom and what does and doesn't work. The teachers don't even know. The teachers know it from their perspective and the students know it from theirs. They need to be asked and listened to. You know that.
Well, despite all this and on a hugely positive note, in the space of 18 months in Northern Ireland, we've had the opening of the Lyric, which is a wonderful building, we've had the opening of the MAC, which is a wonderful building, and we're about to have the opening of the Causeway Visitor Centre, which is a wonderful building, all of which have been subject of design competitions. And if you look at the past in Northern Ireland, another wonderful building was the Marketplace Theatre in Armagh, which was the subject of a design competition. So I think the answer is to have more design competitions and make sure that CPD keep their hands on it.
I think that is an answer.
That puts the RSUA at the heart of the process as well, which is key.
I think also one of the key, and maybe just has been highlighted here, one of the key elements of demonstrating or evidencing our value, and that seems to be the word that we're batting around, is that it's not coming from CPD, that it's not coming from ourselves, but it's coming from the clients. And if more clients stand up and say, yes, there may be discussions that are heated, but they actually can see the value of having a, I think that's very clearly positioned today, the value of having a direct access to the clients, to the architect, will actually send the right message to CPD, send the right message to government, and send the right message to the wider society that actually, yes, you know, we can advertise in papers and so forth, but actually by clients standing up and saying, you know, go with an architect, you know, work with them directly, you know, and you will see the value to the society as well as to the business. And the more perhaps that we bat around you know, our value and our perception of ourselves, you know, we're probably playing the same game that we've always played before, and we need to put it out to those that are commissioning us. The key drivers.
And the big problem with CPD is, I think, that the process has become an end in itself. They have usually just totally ignore the end product now. The whole process, which they blame on the European system, and which they zealously implement, more so in Northern Ireland, I think, than anywhere else. And Norman was said earlier, we did meet the CPD last week in the presence of the Minister, Sammy Wilson. And we did make all these points, and we didn't beat about the bush. And I think for once we had a serious discussion, and I think for once we got the message through that the whole business of the way buildings are procured in Northern Ireland, I mean, it is an absolute nonsense, and it's a total waste of money as well. And then, of course, we have Titanic Belfast, which is a public club. and let's not be sniffy about that. Because at least we have a building.
But you know,
everybody loves, you know.
I mean, prophets are often not recognised their own land. I know. Mac and Lyric have already been recognised well outside this island. I think those things need to be exploited institutionally by RSUA.
Absolutely.
To tell people at home what the rest of the world is saying.
Absolutely.
I'm conscious it's now 6:15. The panel can stay where they are. I'd like to thank the panel. As I said, I don't think I could have said it better at all. Really appreciate Alistair and Eleanor, Alish, Shane, that it has shown a fantastic sort of how difficult it is to be an architect, how wonderful it is to be an architect, how wonderful it is to be a client. I haven't heard such a glowing, sort of description of the process. But really, really pleased I am if you were able to speak. Everybody, I appreciate all of our guests have a very busy schedule, and we're really grateful for you coming today. Thank you very much indeed.